we began this by reading a tshuva of Moshe Feinstein, who said that there should not be any problem with grape juice as long as it's automated and pasteurized before it's bottled, and there's no actual human contact with the juice. And
it doesn't have to be pasteurized.
Either one would do. Right. But since all grape juice is both automated and pasteurized, there's a double reason why one should allow it. But nevertheless, as you well know, that particular decision has not been accepted. And the reason that it's not been accepted might be simply because of a general tendency to be machmir, which has taken place in the Jewish, Orthodox Jewish community in the past 40 or 50 years. Or it might be because of marketing skills of Mr. Herzog, or it might be because...
You don't have to. You don't have to.
Or it might be because of a peculiar taboo which seems to be associated with all forms of Yayin Nesach. So in this particular case, where neither or none of the original reasons to prohibit grape wine should apply to pasteurized and bottled grape juice, nevertheless, this prohibition has become widespread. Yes?
By Feinstein's formulation, pasteurized or automated.
Well, he gives two reasons.
I guess gives the implication that he doesn't want any contamination by anybody touching it.
He doesn't want contamination by anyone touching it before it's pasteurized.
Before it's
pasteurized. Once the thing is cooked, then it has the status of yayin mevushah.
Okay, and I think, by the contrary, that you wouldn't want anyone to touch it after it's been.
No, no. The as far as the halakhic reason is concerned, for medical reasons, it has nothing to do with microbiology. It has to do with the fact that after all, this was a discovery. Before Pasteur, this would not have been known or possible. But it might very well have been a known phenomenon in ancient times that if you do cook the wine, then it will not ferment and turn into wine, but it'll just spoil. In other words, whatever bacteria will fall into the wine and cause it to spoil will be like any other juice will spoil, but not yield wine. So that may have been one of the reasons why originally cooked wine was not considered as being subject to any of these prohibitions. But in any event, you have pasteurized grape juice which has not come in contact with any human. So that, and certainly grape juice is no different a beverage, since it's non-alcoholic, than orange juice or cranberry juice or apple juice or any other kind of juice. So neither of the underlying reasons for the prohibition would apply. And furthermore, from a technical halachic point of view, there's no reason to apply the prohibition. So even if you don't want to accept the fact that the prohibitions of the reasons for the original prohibition may no longer apply, but nevertheless the prohibition is in force because of the ruling that if a prohibition comes into effect, only a court can revoke that prohibition, and a court which has at least the same authority as the original court. But even from a technical point of view, it should be permitted, and nevertheless, it's commonly accepted, and I wouldn't dare invite someone to my house and serve them a glass of Welch's grape juice. We will find, however, that this business of applying are not necessarily logical means to enforce a prohibition which should no longer necessarily apply, accompanies this particular prohibition all the way back. We'll trace it all the way back to the Gemara. There have been places in which there's been some reluctance to accept a permissible ruling. And I will distribute an article by Rabbi Soloveitchik on one aspect of this halacha, which is the aspect that we began to study, namely the issue of when crushed grapes turn into what's considered yayin, that is, are liable to this prohibition. We'll only read the end of it in the middle when we get to this point, but then again, here's another situation in which there have been any number of cases in which a lenient ruling could have taken place, but in fact, such a lenient ruling did not take place. Now, what I will do is first begin with the relevant texts of the Gemara that have to do with the general issue of the type of non-Jew who might render the wine prohibited, that is, what happens when in fact the, this is not it, what happens, that was yours? Or?
No,
that was just in there. Okay, now, so I want to pass out again the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, because we will read it fairly closely. I Zirach, Daf Nun Zayin Amud Beis, and Daf Nun Chet Amud Aleph, but we will start a little bit before there, so you'll have to trust me that I'm reading the Gemara accurately, and we will pass a little bit after there. Okay? And what this Gemara has to do is with the issue of intent and capability of intent. Okay. So you should have, and here's the other Daf Nun Chet. Okay, so I'm reading a few lines before the Gemara that I passed out. Yeah, that's also not part of this. Okay, so on the Zion number Aleph, which I did not. Xerox. It says, "Hahu." So I'm reading from the text that you don't have. "Hahu ogda dahabibit v'veram." A certain event took place. "Dahahu avayit kachavim hakasalik midikla va'aitei lulavi v'hadid v'hadid kanachet naga v'rosh adululeher v'cham v'shalo v'kavan." So the man, a non-Jew, was on the top of a tree, and a branch fell off and fell into the wine unintentionally. Sharye Rav lezavuni lavodei kochamim. Rav permitted this wine to be sold, not to be drunk, but to be sold to a non-Jew. Amru le Rav Kana Ravasi l'Rav. Rav Kana and Ravasi said to Rav, "V'hamaru da'amar, you said." Tinok ben yomohu osei yayin nesek, that even a day-old infant can turn wine. A non-Jewish day-old infant, if his tongue comes in contact with the wine, converts it into stam yayinam. Amar lehu, imur da amri ana b'shtiya. I said that the wine is prohibited to be drunk. You're not allowed to drink the wine. V'hana'at ni amri. But I did not say that a day-old infant can render the wine prohibited even from any kind of benefit. Gufa, now the Gemara discusses that issue altogether. Amarav, tinok ben yomo, say yayinesek, that a day-old child can, if he touches the wine, make it into a yayinesek. Eit be'rav shimi b'chia l'rav. Rav shimi b'chia questioned Rav's decision on the basis of a braita, which says, Elokeach havadim me'ovdei kochavim. If a man buys non-Jewish slaves, Shemalu v'lo tavlu, that they only underwent part of the giyur process. That is, they were circumcised, but they had not yet gone into this one. V'chein b'nei hashvachot, shemalu v'lo tavlu. And similarly, the children of non-Jewish slaves who were circumcised but had not yet gone into the mikvah. V'okanem et rasam v'shuk tameh, v'yamri le'taho, that they have the status of rendering liquids prohibited, the yeinam, but as far as their wine is concerned, the golim osem yayinesech, if they're grown up, they can will make the wine into yayinesech, tanim ein osem yayinesech, but children will not make the wine into yayinesech. Ve'elohim golim ve'elohim tanim, and what is the distinction, how do you draw the line between adults and children as far as this law is concerned? Gdolim yodim b'tiv avodat kochavim umshamshay. That is, if the adult means that they're familiar with idolatrous practices. Tanim einam yodim b'tiv avodat kochavim umshamshay. But children means those who have not yet been exposed to idolatrous practice. So the Braita seems to indicate that a non-Jew who has not, who's a child who has not yet been exposed to idolatrous practice, does not render the wine into yayinet. Ketanim mihat gdolim ketanim lo. But it says, adults yes and children no. Tirgama Rav explains that away, Abnei Shvachot. It's not talking about actual non-Jews, that isn't Jews, but children of slaves in a Jewish household. כן, לאפוקי מדרב נחמן אמר שמואל, דאמר רב נחמן אמר שמואל, הלוקח עבדים מן הקוף על יתקוף עבדים. If someone buys slaves from a non-Jew, אף על פי שמלו וטבלו, עושים יד נסה. Even if they have converted, they've undergone the formal conversion procedure, they've been circumcised and gone to the mikvah, nevertheless, their contact will make the wine into yayin nesech ad shetishaka vodat kochadim mipiyem, until they have been sufficiently absorbed into the Jewish household that they do not practice their idolatry. Obviously this is talking about a kind of slave in which the conversion process was enforced on him. He didn't voluntarily decide to become a slave in this household, and therefore it's conceivable that he still may retain his idolatrous practice. Kamash b'mah, gufa. Amar Rav Nachman Amar Shmuel, halokeach avadim en oved kochadim, af al pi shemalu v'tavlu osin yayin nesech, ad shetishka avodat kochadim mipihem. V'kama, and how long will it take to presume that they've lost their ways of idolatry? On Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, ad shnei masal chodesh. It should take a year. That is, if they've been living in the Jewish household for a year, it can be presumed that they no longer are practicing their original religion. Eight mirav alav Rav Nachman halokeach avodim neavod kochavim shemalu velo tavlu v'chenosh ben hashvachot shemalu velo tavlu v'okonim ad rasan v'shuk panei. Now I'm come to the Gemara that you have, that's in Zion on the base, so you can read inside. V'amri le tahor yeinam gedolim osim yayin nesach hanim ein osim yayin nesach. Eilu hem gedolim ve'eilu hem ktanim. Who are the adults and who are the children? Gedolim sheyodim b'teva avodat kochavim u'mesham shei. Katanim she'en yodim b'teva avodat kochavim v'misham she'. Katanim mihat malu v'lo tavlu in malu v'tavlu lo. Tirgama b'nei shvachot. That it applies only to the children of maidservants, but not to actually acquired slaves. V'hochein v'chein katani. It says similarly. Elkanim edrasan. It's referring to issues of tumah v'tara. Hanich elamandi amar tamei elamandi amar tahor ma'ich elameimah. הקמש מולן, עבדים דומיאל בני שפחות. מה בני שפחות? גדולים הודי עושים יין נסק, קטנים אין עושים יין נסק. אף עבדים, just like the children don't, similarly, אף עבדים נמי, גדולים עושים יין נסק, קטנים אין עושים יין. נו צריך להפוקי מדרה. And that excludes Rav's opinion, the Amar Rav, that Rav said, תינוק בן יומו עושים יין נסק, קמש מולן דולו. So, there are basically two disputes going on here, which are seemingly unrelated. One is the issue of whether when you acquire a slave and possibly convert him by performing circumcision and putting him through the mikvah, whether he automatically becomes completely Jewish as far as the law of the Ayin Nesach is concerned, because after all, you haven't changed his mind about anything. This was not necessarily a voluntary conversion. That's one issue. And the second issue, which would be seemingly unrelated to this, or at least logically unrelated, is the issue of whether a child, Rob says, even a day-old infant, if he comes in contact with the wine, makes it into Yayin Nesech or not. These seemingly unrelated problems are related because of that particular text, which seems to deal with both questions at once. So that's the only thing that I wanted to bring up here. So there's a difference of opinion between Rob and Shmuel, actually, as to whether a Tinok Ben Yomo or say Yayin Nesech or not. Rob says that he does make it into Yayin Nesach, and Shmuel says no. And this dispute is only as far as the laws of drinking are concerned. But as far as Isur Hana'a is concerned, even Rav will agree that a Tinok Ben Yomo does not render the wine so prohibited that you cannot derive any benefit from it. You simply cannot drink it. And now we're going to go through several cases which will illustrate things that are at issue here. Hahu Uvda the Habib of Machoza. There was a certain event that took place in the town of Machoza. Ata Oved Kochavim, an idolater, Ayala Hanuta di Israel, and came into a Jewish store. Amar Lahu, and he said to the storekeepers, Itluchu Chamur Lizvuni, do you have any wine for sale? Amru Le Lo. They said, no, we don't have any wine for sale. Habiyativ Chamur Bedavla. There was a bucket of wine sitting right there. There was just some wine sitting in a bucket right on the table, if you like, on the shelf. Shadi beyadei, the non-Jew stuck his hand into the barrel of wine, sech seifo, and shook it around. Amar lahu, hai lav hamuhu, isn't this wine? How can you tell me that there's no wine for sale? Here's a bucket of wine right there on the shelf, ready to be sold. One of the storekeepers got so angry that he took this bucket of wine, v'shadye ledanam, and then he threw it back into the barrel. He was just outraged that his honesty was questioned when he was being dishonest, and threw the wine back into the barrel. And now comes the issue as to what is the status of all of the wine that's in the barrel. Okay. Sharye rava lizvune lavoro kachavim. Right. You can't derive any benefit from the wine. Okay, so the issue was what to do. So there are two issues: what to do with the actual wine that was poured back into the barrel, and also what to do with all the wine that's in the barrel that came mixed up with this wine. Okay, so let's see what happened here. Sharye Rava lezvunei lavodei kochavim. Rava allowed this barrel of wine to be sold to non-Jews. Ifligale Rav Huna bar Chinuna, Rav Huna b'Reid Rav Nachman. Rav Huna bar Chinuna and Rav Huna b'Reid Rav Nachman, these two Rav Hunas, different fathers, but the same name Rav Huna, disagreed with Rav. Nachak shipurei de Rava v'shaul, then Rava's heralds, that is, Rava's newspaper, or however they disseminated information in those days, allowed this, proclaimed that this was permitted. And therefore there was a proclamation by the opposite side, a poster, right, and prohibited it. An email circulated saying, on both sides, saying that these things were prohibited. Rav Huna b'Reid Rav Nachman l'Machuza. Rav Huna b'Reid Rav Nachman came to Machuza, Rava's hometown where all of this was taking place. Amar le Rava lo Rav Eliakim Shamei. Rava said to Rav Eliakim, his assistant, a servant, Trok trok gali, de lo nitnu inish dinitrid. Lock the doors so that nobody will come and bother me. Okay? Lock the doors well so that no one will come and bother me. Nevertheless, Ola Gabe. Nevertheless, Rav Huna came to Rava's house, and Amar le ki hai gav namai. If such a case would arise, what would be the ruling? And Rava said, Amale asur, afilu bahana'a, that the wine should be prohibited even to derive any benefit from. V'hamahu da'amar sikhsech eno sinya yineseh. And Rava, but you are the one that said in that particular case that it doesn't make it into yineseh. So Rava says, Emor da'am riana, levar midme da'ahu chamo. That he could sell that whole barrel but not derive any benefit from the amount of wine that was in the bucket. In other words, he could sell the whole barrel of wine and then remove whatever the price of the wine that was in the bucket and get rid of that, but he didn't have to lose the entire value of the barrel of wine. Did I say that he was allowed to have the value of that wine? Rashi says, "Demedahu chama, dahava bidav limi amrinan, modina beidet sarich laholich damav liyam amelach." That I agree that whatever the value, that proportion of wine is, he should throw the coins that he derives from that into the Dead Sea. Udmei shar hayayin shebachavit mutav, but the rest of the value of the wine that he got from selling the whole barrel was permissible. Umishum kisufa al ka'ama haki. But Rava said this because he was embarrassed. Aval ihu kule shari. In fact, his original ruling was to allow to derive benefit from the entire wine. The whole issue here is that because the fact that the non-Jew scooped out that wine and says, isn't this wine, there was a specifically contrary intent on his part, then you know that he didn't touch the wine for libation purposes. And the theoretical issue here is, if the contact is specifically for a purpose that you can determine other than libation, do you suspect that there was libation? And on this issue, Rava was embarrassed to admit that his original ruling allowed even the wine that was in the bucket. And now, why did Rava change his mind on this issue? Amar Rava, ki atoy la pampadita, when I came to Pampadita, he apparently, Rava visited Pampadita in between the actual event that he ruled on and Rav Huna's visit, and there he met Abaye. Akvam nachmeni shmaita umatnitin de asu. That Abaye convinced me by bringing both a argument and a mishnah that prohibits it. Shmaita dahu uvda dahavi ben ahavda, that there was such a case that arose in ahavda, va'asar Shmuel, v'tveriya va'asar Rav Yochanan. And I said to him, the reason that Shmuel and Rabbi Yochanan prohibited the wine in those two particular towns, lefisha einan b'nei Torah, because the Jews in those towns are ignorant, and therefore, if you allowed this particular case, they would extend the permission to cover all other similar cases in which the wine would be prohibited, and therefore, Shmuel and Rav Yochanan imposed a more stringent ruling than was halachically necessary. The Amarli, and then Abaye said to me, Tveriya v'nadai non b'nei Torah, the Mahuza b'nei Torah, are you telling me that the Jews who were living in Tiberias and in Arda were ignorant, that the Jews in living in Mahuza are well educated? And to that, Rava had no response. So that was one argument that Abaye brought that said that the wine should be prohibited. Machnita, and similarly a brayta which said the agardimim oved kolchavim, a market supervisor. In other words, they used to have inspectors who would see the quality, whether the weights were accurate and the measures were accurate, and whether the quality of the wine was accurate. In other words, the government would have people going around to the various markets to examine what was being sold to see if there were no unfair business practices going on. The agar b'mim oved kochavim shekadach b'meineket be'ela, that a non-Jewish market inspector who drilled a hole and sucked out a certain amount of wine in order to taste it to check whether the quality of wine met the standards of the community. So he either sucked it up with a tube or actually tasted it from a cup. Or that he grew the wine out in a cup and then poured the rest of it back into the barrel. This was an event. And they prohibited the remaining wine that was in the barrel. So here was a situation in which there was a definite purpose for the non-Jew of coming in contact with the wine, because he was doing his job as a wine inspector, but nevertheless, the wine was prohibited. My lav bahana, so doesn't that imply that this was all prohibited even to derive benefit from? Lo vishtia. No, Rava argues that that didn't mean that the barrel wine was prohibited to derive any benefit from, in which case you couldn't sell it to a non-Jew, but rather that Jews were not allowed to drink it. Ihachi, if that's the case, that the only prohibition was one of drinking, but not one of deriving benefit from it, lit niyimacher, the writer should say that wine should be sold. Kiriktani seifa, cherem oved kochavim, if a crazy non-Jew, shoshit yado l'chavit, v'chasavur shel shemen, he stuck his hand into a barrel thinking that it was made a barrel of oil, and in fact was a barrel of wine. And in seit shel yayin, ze hayam ma'aseh, there was such a case, where here was a case of an insane person, v'amru yimacher, that it should be sold. So tiyufta derava, tiyufta, the question about rava cannot be answered, and therefore the wine is prohibited. Okay, there's still another case. Rabbi Yochanan bar Arza, Rabbi Yossi bar Nehoroi, have a yatvu kashatu chamo. They were sitting around in the bar drinking some wine. Atahu gavra, the waiter came. Amule ta ashkina. Pour us some more wine. So the waiter was pouring ladle into the barrel and was about to pour wine for both of them. Bata da Rama Lakasa, after he lifted the ladle, Igloi, after he poured the wine into the cup, Igloi milta dovet kochavim. It turns out that the waiter was non-Jewish. Chad asar afilo bahana'a. So one of these two rabbis prohibited any derivation of any, even any kind of a benefit from this wine. The chad shari afilo b'shtia. And one of them said, you're even allowed to drink. Two extreme decisions. Instead of both of them agreeing that you shouldn't drink it, but you're allowed at least to derive some benefit from it, one said you can drink it as much as you want. Right, but he scooped the thing out with a utensil. So now you have a separate problem of touching the wine with a separate utensil, which also is a major technical problem here. Okay, Amar Rav Yehoshua ben Levi. Rav Yehoshua ben Levi said, Manda Asar. Right. Even though there's specifically an intent, all of these three cases are situations in which there was specifically an intent for some other purpose. And the issue is whether, even though there's specifically an intent for some other purpose, is this wine prohibited? And if it is prohibited, is it prohibited to drink, or is it prohibited even to derive any benefit from it? So that is precisely the abstract issue here. There was, except now it's complicated by the fact that the contact wasn't directly with a man's hand, but with a ladle or some other utensil. So there, but the principal issue is, there is specific intent for another purpose. Does that remove the prohibition of Yayin Nefer? And Rava maintained, before he was embarrassed or before he changed his mind, that it was permissible, even Bahana'a, but not Bishtia, and then he changed his mind and said it was prohibited Bishtia.
So if there was such an issue, there is such an issue, and there has a kosher wine in the law,
mm-hmm.
Why
was they thought he was Jewish. Turned out.
The man who hired him?
The two rabbis. They didn't realize that this barkeeper, or wherever they were drinking the wine, would be so foolish as to hire a non-Jewish waiter. Okay? So now, it now becomes an issue of psychology. Amar Rav Yehoshua ben Levi. Rav Yehoshua ben Levi says, and then I'm going to read a bit beyond the Gemara that you have, Manda Asar Shapir Asar, Umanda Shari Shapir Shari. Both of these rabbis had good reasons for their contradictory opinions. Manda Asar, the person who prohibited, Meima Amal, he thought, Salka Daite de Rabbanan Kihani Shikha Kashatu, Elevadai, Hi, Chamwa Kashatu, Ve'naske. The waiters say two distinguished rabbis wouldn't be drinking such a lowly drink as beer. Certainly they must be drinking wine, and therefore the waiter must have realized that the pitcher or whatever the jug was on the table from which he was labeling out the drink must have been wine, and therefore he performed the libation. Mandashari Shapo Shari, and the person who permitted the even to drink it, Meimar Amar Saitu Dachtit Rabbanan Kihani Chamwash Kashatu V'Amale L'Didi Tashkinan, that these rabbis would be drinking wine and they would ask me to ladle out the wine, knowing that it would prohibit the wine, so they certainly couldn't have been drinking wine, but therefore must have been drinking beer. Ela Vadai Shikrahu Kashatu V'Lo Nasche. So therefore the waiter was assuming that the drink was beer. So he can tell the difference. You can look at it and see the difference between wine and beer. It was late at night and it was dark and you couldn't tell the difference between wine and beer. But the wine and beer smell differently. You should be able to tell from the odor that they look different. It was new wine which didn't have yet a distinctive odor. Now your question, that he didn't actually come in direct contact with this liquid, he only had it with the ladle. That it was a contact without intent, so even if it was out intent, it was prohibited. That he didn't pour it out with a ladle, but was pouring from a bottle, that is from a whatever they call them, flask. That even though if there was no intent, then it would be permissible. Okay. So, whatever, at every event, the main thing for us is that we see that there's a dispute between Rav and Shmuel on the contact between of a day-old infant with wine. Rav says that that's prohibited to drink, and Shmuel says that it's permissible to drink. Now, as we saw last time, the practice in Germany, at least, prior to Rashi, was that the Jews were involved only indirectly in the wine business by investing, collecting debts in the wine business, and actually investing. And Rashi also allowed, he found a tshuva sadaonim, which said that nowadays, when there is no libation performed by anyone, non-Jews have the same status as a day-old infant in the time of the Gemara. So therefore, their wine should not be prohibited of deriving any benefit from, but nevertheless, is prohibited as far as drinking is concerned. So in principle, that would mean that Jews should be allowed to go into the wine business in a big way, but Rashi resisted drawing the logical conclusion and said only that if it turns out to be the case that payment from a debtor, if a Jewish creditor has payment from a debtor in kind in the form of wine, he's allowed to accept it, because if he doesn't, he will lose his principal. But he has to sell it right away and can't keep the wine and wait for a good market price. The issue is whether or not that reflected actual practice in Germany. And the evidence seems to be, according to Rabbi Professor Soloveitchik, that it did not. So let me just quote from this particular book. So, in other words, the rabbis, principally Rashi, were willing to go so far as to allow payment in kind for a debt in the form of wine, but not to allow Jews to go into investment in the wine business altogether. And now I'm just simply reading from a couple of pages in Rabbi Soloveitchik's book, not in the article. So this was what the situation was as far as the scholars of Ashkenaz were concerned. Well, what about the actual traders? Did they, in fact, also abide by the ancient taboo against getting involved in non-Jewish wine? Did, in fact, the traders, Jewish traders in Ashkenaz, not allow themselves to derive any benefit from the wine trade, which was the biggest trade which was going on in that area, in the Rhineland, during that time, in Lorraine, or in Franconia, or in Schwabing? That's where most of the Jews were living for that particular time. In fact, was it even possible to simply give up on this main source of business and income during that time? So he quotes two pieces of evidence that, in fact, the actual practice in Germany was not the one that Rashi recommended, but was a bit more lenient, that is, which allowed the Jews to invest in the wine business, if not necessarily to actually be owners of vineyards and so on. Because, first of all, there was a famous takanot of shum. There were takanot that were Jewish communities made of the three Jewish communities, Speyer, Ramayza, and Mainz, in the years 1221, 1222, 1223. There was a whole series of rabbinical enactments. And in paragraph 9, it says that a person shouldn't derive benefit, istakeir, that is, be employed, as far as yayin nesach is concerned. And here the wording is very strange. It doesn't say
that he shouldn't trade in wine or that he shouldn't derive any benefit in wine, but rather he simply should not be involved in the wine producing business. Similarly, he should not be working in a wine press, he shouldn't buy wine and so on, but it doesn't say that he shouldn't be trading in wine. The language is very queer. I mean, if all that the language wanted to say is that a person shouldn't derive any benefit from wine, it should use the language of the Gemara, saying that no benefit is allowed to be derived from wine. But what in fact... Yes. They owned land in the 10th and the 11th century. And in fact, it turns out that they were major investors in land, and even in vineyards, up through the 10th or 11th century. And then they switched over to investing. They would lend money to the wine owners. They would invest in the production of the wine in the form of extending capital, but they wouldn't actually own any of the vineyards or the wine presses and so on. Or it says, "V'lo yitein adam et yeino b'chaviyot shel goyim im lo yaseh iruy yartiach achavit," that one shouldn't allow put his wine into the barrels of non-Jews unless he kashers the barrels in one form or another. And he shouldn't allow the non-Jew to be pressing Jewish wine. So in other words, there was some attempt on the part of the rabbis who promulgated these enactments, but first of all, it's not clear whether their promulgation was followed. In other words, the very fact that there had to be enactments of this kind is indication that the strict law that they wanted to impress on the community were not in fact followed. And secondly, they were very careful in their wording to avoid saying that a person shouldn't invest in the wine business. They simply are trying to draw a thin line between what's permitted and what's not permitted. And then if in fact you look at the non-Jewish sources, we find at least from the 14th century and by extrapolation back to the 10th, 11th and 12th century, even though we don't have all that many sources from that period, that indeed the Jews were heavily involved in the wine business as investors. So in fact, what was going on here is something that we have seen many times, that when it comes to business in which the person's direct involvement isn't quite there, like for example when we were studying the laws of Goy Shel Shabbat, where one tries to get a non-Jewish partner in order to keep a business going on Shabbat, as long as it didn't intervene directly, in this particular case the line was drawn, the fictional line if you like, was drawn between being an investor in the wine business and actually buying a non-Jewish wine or actually owning the vineyards and treading. And in fact, what's amazing is that throughout all of this period of extremely intense persecution, after all, from 1096 onwards, there were massacres of Jews in this area, starting with the Crusade in 1096, and then various other forms of pogroms that were taking place in the Ashkenazi communities. The heads of the cities, that is, the mayor or the archbishop or whoever was in fact the ruler of the cities, were always inviting the Jews to come back. And the evidence seems to be that the reason for this was that the Jews, despite the fact that they were merely in so-called investors, were in fact the experts in wine production. They could tell which is a good place to plant a new vineyard, what types of wine. So they were heavily involved in not only just simply writing a check and putting out the money, but in fact making all kinds of decisions in the wine business, and that the wine production in these areas couldn't have taken place without a Jewish expertise. Well, the reason was that for their own consumption, they had to produce their wine. In other words, we need wine to make kiddush, abdallah, for various other purposes, and also because wine was the only thing that a respectable person would drink. So if it was something small, like 4 liters of wine per day per person, or something huge, like 16 or 17 liters a day per person, those are sort of the two extremes that we have. The Jews have to produce their own wine. And therefore, and because of the prohibition of Yayinet. So therefore, they became expert in the production of wine. And when they moved into these areas, which are not natural to winemaking, because wine grapes are basically a tropical fruit, and you have to be have a lot of expertise to know how to grow it precisely in the right amount of sunlight and water and everything else, they also were involved in the production of their own wine and achieved a huge amount of expertise. But once wine in the 10th century became a major commodity, if you're talking not about just having enough wine for the various small number of Jewish families that existed in the region, but export to England, export to France, export to all the northern countries, there was an economic revival in the 10th and the 11th century, which, as we mentioned last time, was disruptive of traditional Christianity and caused an outbreak of new kinds of anti-Semitism. So if you want to get into that business, you can't manage with non-Jewish, with only Jewish traders. You don't have enough of them, nowhere near enough. And therefore, if you are trying to get into that business, the legal fiction that you use to avoid the prohibition of the Yayin Nesach was not to actually own the vineyards or be the producer of the wine yourself, but merely be an investor. But in this particular context, being an investor didn't mean like you invest in the stock market without getting involved in knowing how this particular company runs or doesn't run, but it meant being an investor meant being involved in the technical decisions that had to go forward in the actual production of the wine. Well, there was plenty of literature who found the Jewish law that said that any wine that was touched by a non-Jew became prohibited as obnoxious. This was certainly a cause of hatred of the Jews. This was not something that they didn't know. But there's also evidence that there was a major involvement of the Jews in the wine business. So we have a sort of strange balance here between, on the one hand, retaining an ancient taboo, and on the other hand, getting around some of the technical difficulties when it came to business practice. Okay. Expert in the field that he was doing, in this case viticulture, which was the principal form of economic activity in that area of the world and at that time. So there remains a couple of questions. One is, why did the taboo remain? In other words, and it's pretty clear that there was, and through everything that we've seen, that there was a great reluctance to simply declare the law no longer applicable, as we do for bread or for dealing in business practices with non-Jews 3 days prior to their holidays and so on. No one says that you can't own a toy store and sell toys in the Christmas season, which according to the Gemara should be prohibited. So for that, let's take a look in. Go back to Daf Nun Zayin on the base. Right. La'afuke midorav ve'amar tinok ben yomo. Hashta chazinan, here we see the lahai lishna, that according to that version of the Gemara, the Amri Le Tahor, that says that that the various liquids that these semi-converted slaves come into contact with are Tahor, Shmuel let le derav. But Shmuel disagrees with Rav, the Amar Tinok Ben Yomavuhu. In other words, this is a difference of opinion between Shmuel and Rav as to whether contact with a infant non-Jew renders the wine prohibited to drink. The imkein lo at yahayman itakave ele itle l'shmuel. Therefore, Shmuel must maintain that tinok ben yomo eno yosei yain nesach umutar after shtiyah. that an infant does not make the wine into a yayin esek, and therefore it is permissible even to drink. Uhu hadin, and therefore it would follow, especially with the interpretation of that right, the ketanim she'ein yodim b'tiv avodat kochavim, that it refers even to children, not necessarily to day-old infants, so long as they are not accustomed to idolatrous practices. Uven yomo lav davka. And therefore, when Shmuel says that ben yomo would be permissible, doesn't mean necessarily a day-old infant. Bavadim gdolim, but slaves who are adults, afal pishem alu v'tavlu, even though they've formally undergone the complete conversion process,